Next, land comment.
Good afternoon, Chairman, and Chair Gabbard, members of the committees. My name is Lance Collins. I am an attorney that primarily works in good government. I have been working with some of, primarily on the natural resources side of this issue, and that's actually what I researched to speak about today. Although I did want to just point out first this question about the wage standards with labor. And somebody back here may know more about this than me. This hasn't been well researched by me, but the Jones Act provides minimum standards. There's a few other federal laws that provide minimum standards for seamen or crew members that are under its jurisdiction. When the federal minimum wage law was adopted, the fishing industry at the time in the 1930s asked for an industry-wide exemption in the way that agriculture has an industry-wide exemption. And those proposals were defeated. And instead, the fishing industry has fishing-specific, job-specific exemptions from the federal minimum wage standards law. Hawaii's law, which was passed after that, actually is even more restrictive than what it covers. And I think it's a reasonable position in 2007 when you folks amended that law to eliminate the exemption for seamen in general and only give the exemption to people who carry merchant marine licenses, that actually the coverage of Hawaii's wage standards law does cover these individuals that work in these ships. And I'm not sure what the department is going to be here from the Department of Labor today, but I don't believe that the Attorney General has looked at that issue carefully, and you know, somebody from the Wage Standards Division could probably speak more to that. There, even if an industry is exempted from the minimum wage standards, there are still a variety of wage standards provisions that are applicable to all persons who are employed by Hawaii employers. And so the people who are in these ships in our harbors that all have Hawaii commercial marine licenses that are they're all subject to those, and whether or not the State Department of Labor is actively enforcing it is a separate issue. But as a matter of law, all of those laws apply. Whether they're being enforced is an entirely separate issue. Another issue that was brought up is these agencies that act as intermediaries. There is a law that if you are acting as an agent in the state, you have to be registered with the DCCA. That is another area that is not being enforced. And it may be true that the agency is technically based in Kiribati or the Philippines or whatever, but the agency relationship is ongoing, and it's Hawaii businesses that are paying these agents from Hawaii, and they still have to be registered with the state and license. Okay, now, on to natural resources, which is what I'm was here to speak about. The first issue is that the current licensing, commercial marine licensing regime, prohibits the issuance of licenses to persons who are not lawfully admitted to the United States territories or their possessions. And that's at HRS 189-5. Now, someone who is subject to an I-295, I know there were several different I numbers said earlier, but it's actually the I-295, which is a deportation order. And it's this sort of great procedure that is used to allow foreign workers to be on the ships but not actually leave the boats. They're detained on board. But it's a deportation order saying that they're deported, and the method of execution is that they will be detained on board by their captain until they leave Hawaii waters. So if someone is subject to a deportation order, why are they subject to a deportation order? Because they are not lawfully admitted to the United States. Because if you're lawfully admitted to the United States, you wouldn't be subject to deportation. So I think there's a question presently about whether or not the DLNR is actually complying with express state law in its licensing, but it may be licensing individuals that clearly violate present law. And 189.5, by the way, was adopted in 1929. So it's not like there was some recent law and the AGs haven't had time to figure this out. This has been around for, 90 years. The other issue with the DLNR has to do, it's very disturbing to hear, and I'm sorry that that Dr. Henderson has left, very disturbing to hear some of the statements that he made regarding language access to these licenses. In his advice to the land board to deny the petition for rulemaking recently, he said that the department's position was that these people have to comply with the terms of the license whether or not they understand it. And from a natural resource perspective, management perspective, it's disturbing because the purpose of natural resource management is to manage the resources. And so if you're looking to the prosecution part of that cycle, you're waiting for the crime to happen first before you do anything. And if you're trying to manage and protect resources, that's not the part of the enforcement cycle that you should be focused on. So it's disturbing on that side. It's also disturbing because the statements that were made appear to conflict, I won't quote them, but appear to conflict with the state's obligations under Title VI of the Civil Rights Act. The DOJ and the DOI have both provided substantial guidance to states regarding language access issues. And this issue about, well, if people want to request a translator, we'll look around for one, is so far removed from the state's obligation under Title VI, I'm not sure what the federal government's going to do if it gets back to them. But not just that, it also violates agencies' obligations under HRS 321C, which is the state's language access law. It was disturbing to hear from Dr. Anderson that the DLNR does not have a plan, which all state agencies are required to have regarding language access to limited English proficient persons, when more than an insubstantial number of the people they interact with are of limited English proficiency. And it was also disturbing to hear that the DLNR, that at least from Dr. Anderson's perspective, there is no coordinator for the department to deal with these issues. The numbers he said is that there's 3,400 licensees, and if 700 of them are longliners, and we only assume that those 700, of the 700, some portion are limited English proficiency and not the other 2,800, 2,700. Just from the numbers that were given by him and Mr. Cook, at least Tagalog translation should be required under both federal and state law, because there is a statistical, substantial number of limited English proficient Tagalog-speaking people just by what was said here today, without looking at possibly also Indonesian, Bahasa Indonesia. But if you look at that 700, and most of those 700 are limited English proficient speaking people, these documents should, the license application should already, and the instructions and the terms should already be translated into the language that these people speak. And so there's obviously a need for some education with the department, and it's too bad that Dr. Anderson is not here. There is definitely a need by the DLNR to become aware of its obligations under the Title VI of the Civil Rights Act and also under Chapter 321C. The final point that I wanted to make has to do with the universal crew contracts. When people propose things, it's really good, but as a litigator, you look at it the other way, which is, okay, these guys have this contract, so what happens, as my contracts law professor said years ago, what happens to the dirty contract breaker? Well, if the crew member breaks the contract, I think we have a clear idea of what happens. They get sent home, or something else worse may happen to them. But what happens when the owner or the agency breaks the contract? Well, let's take a Filipino fisherman who's detained on board status. Well, does he go to a Hawaii court to enforce his rights under the breach? Well, how does he get to a Hawaii court? How does he contact a Hawaii lawyer to get to a Hawaii court? Okay, so maybe he actually has to bring this case in the Philippines against the agency that he works for. Okay, so he has to wait, first of all, until he gets back to the Philippines, then he has to find a lawyer. Then the lawyer has to hope that the agency still exists that signed the contract. And then if you read the newspaper, you know, Marcos has been dead for 30 years, and there's still cases involving the money that he had, property that he stole from the Philippine government that are ongoing. So the likelihood of a Philippine fisherman who's subject to detained on board deportation order, being able to enforce the breach of his contract is, from a litigator's perspective, is a joke. So it's nice that they're here, and I know that most sailors are men of their word. That's really great, but the problem is the ones that are being are abused are the ones that are usually being abused by people who aren't keeping their words. And there is no, they may have a technical or symbolic protection, but there's no way to actually enforce it under a universal crew contract. And so that's the problem with the universal crew contract. The market and the industry cannot solve this problem on its own because it's something that requires the power of the government to protect these individuals. That's why we have labor protection laws, that's why we have fair labor standards. And if you leave it to a universal crew contract, it's for persons who are subject to deportation orders if they step foot off of Pier 18 or Pier 17 or Pier 38. You know, the problem is that they'll get deported. And so there's no way to enforce these crew contracts. So it's maybe good for a majority of them or half of them, but for the ones that are being subject to the abuse, there is no effective remedy.
Questions?
Just a couple of comments, please.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Collins, I wonder if the citation that you made regarding the minimum wage, you could put that in writing and we provide it to the Chair for distribution so that those of us today can follow on.
I think there's 10 exemptions. It used to be seaman, and then in 2007 it was narrowed to persons who work on vessels that have merchant marine licenses.
Okay. And the other thing I think that you bring up regarding language access is a concern. It has been kind of tossed around. It was in labor, it's now in health. It's kind of an orphan that doesn't have a home, and I think that we have to take it seriously. I know that the State Department of Labor had been working with the federal government to try to resolve that issue, and I guess the rest of the state needs to be cognizant of the fact that it is a concern and we need to do better at dealing with that. So thank you for bringing that up. Thank you, Chair.
Just one quick question. So, in your point of view, the absence of lawsuits have been used as evidence for no wrongdoing. Is that fair?
It means absolutely nothing. The fact that there hasn't been lawsuits makes no statement as to the state of, as I just explained, if you can't get off the ship without getting deported. I did see one instance where someone did complain, and I believe it's the Jones Act, there are certain instances where a boat captain or the boat owner is required to repatriate a seaman. And under that provision, that person was repatriated, and then the boat captain attempted to take that out of the person's pay, and somehow Customs and Border Patrol somehow got involved and said, no, he wasn't deported under our orders. You had to repatriate him under the Jones Act or whatever, and so that ended up going that way. But most of the time these guys go home and they don't know that they have any rights under the Jones Act. They don't know they have any rights under anything. They realize, okay, they have this contract, but where do they go to enforce it? Philippine courts? Does anybody keep statistics on Indonesian and Philippine courts that are enforcing these agencies? The boats don't have that because the contracts aren't with them, they're with the agencies.
If they got to a court and filed a lawsuit, what type of resource would it take to have a chance at winning when you're up against, what Jim said, $700,000 a year?
Oh, yeah, probably none. some of these contracts, if it's $300 a month or something, and then they take out for this and that, some of it which actually sounds like it violates employees' wage standards law, some of them may be in small claims courts. I don't know that, you have to be able to step foot in Hawaii in order to file something in small claims court in the first place. But if it's something more substantial, you still have this problem where if the trade group gets involved and they have this $1 million a year budget, there's no way that these guys who are making $300 or $500 a month, minus all of the deductions, you know, could possibly bring any kind of suit.
And lastly, you know, you said that this isn't a situation that the market can fix on its own. Government intervention is needed. I agree. But so far, the market has done more to move the needle on this issue, from Whole Foods to Costco to other vendors, raising eyebrows, if not more, about the practices here. What explicitly do you think we should do at the state? On a regulatory level, and well, we talked a lot, actually, we offered a few things at the regulatory level, but on the legislative level as well.
Well, I mean, I disagree with Dr. Anderson. I do believe that the state presently has the power to include all of the information that was requested, both in the petition by the people who asked for rulemaking and what you mentioned earlier today. The DLNR presently has the power to do that. The power to license is a broad power. It's part of the police power. So, and all of this informational stuff, which doesn't require the licensee to do anything other than furnish additional information, is required. Can be required. It would be absurd to say that the power to license includes the power to require eye color and hair color, but not copies of documents demonstrating that they're the person is lawfully admitted to the United States, when the statute specifically says licenses can only go to people who are lawfully admitted to the United States. So that's one thing. The DLNR does have the broad power, but of course there are some issues where the DLNR, for whatever reason, can't or won't do it. And that's where the legislature can step in and just tell them, you will do it that way.
Okay, so in your legal opinion, or not legal opinion, but in your opinion, if some of the suggestions we had today on the regulatory level, if DLNR wanted to start promulgation tomorrow, they could?
They could, and they actually have, they're in the, apparently in the process of changing the rules for the licenses right now, and the final proposal hasn't been approved yet, so they could always just add it to that process, and that's the whole point of a very long administrative rule process. All these issues come up and then they get put in, so they actually could put them in the current, their own proposed process if they wanted to.
Okay, thank you.
Oh, and I just wanted to say one more thing, I think Jim Cook was just misunderstood. The Philippines is not, its economy is not primarily based on remittances from people overseas. It's about 9% of the GDP. So I just wanted to correct that. The Philippines economy is very big, and although it does rely on some extent to remittances, it's only about 9% of GDP. So I'm sorry. Thank you.